Fulfill my cup, let it overflow. Fulfill my cup, let it overflow. Fulfill my cup, let it overflow. Let it overflow with love.
Good morning and welcome to We Are Just Christians. Thank you so much for tuning in today to our program. My name is Mike Schmidt, and We Are Just Christians is brought to you by The Church of Christ on Savona Boulevard as part of our work and teaching. And with me, as usual, is my partner, Gary Jones. How are you, Gary?
I'm here this morning, Mike.
Great. Gary and I are the elders of the church here on Savona Boulevard. And we have this show called We Are Just Christians to teach about being just a Christian and not part of some denomination, and try to get past a lot of the conflict and confusion that's out there in the religious world and go back to the Bible. Now, we happen to believe not only is that the right course of action, but it's actually probably something a lot of people want. And then, Gary, I think that's what we've, right, seen, we've found.
I think there are many people out there thinking along those lines, and basically that's what we're trying to do here is help in the understanding of the Bible.
Right. We have a lot of guests that come and visit us. They don't all stay as long-term members, as it were, to the church here. But we have a lot of guests who visit us, and what they tell me, oh, I saw your website, which is wearejustchristians.com. And what they're saying is, I'm looking for a church that is undenominational or just to be a Christian. Now, that doesn't mean they're always pleased with what they see. We're not going to say that. But I think we see enough of that to realize that it's an important thing. And I believe that it's important, mostly, Gary, and you do too, because it's what's true and what's right for us to do. We don't have a, I don't think it's useful or good or even scriptural for us to promote some particular denominational doctrine or creed or historic tradition or whatever you want to call it. We're going to teach you the Bible if we can, and look at it for itself, and you need to do the same thing.
Well, that was exactly what Jesus was doing in the Gospels. He was talking to them very straightforward about what was in the Scriptures, and it didn't matter who they were or what direction they were trying to go. He was pointing them to where God was going.
That's probably a good topic, and maybe I'll try to remember this from now on, that I try to look at Scripture, both old and new, in essentially the same way that Jesus did, and using the same principles of interpretation that Jesus used. And I believe that's a fair thing. Most of you would agree, wouldn't you, that if we try to interpret Scriptures in the same way that Jesus did, we'd be on the right track, right?
Right. Well, and I look at all the times, Mike, just think about it, all the times that Jesus used the phrase, have you not read?
Right.
Have you not read this? When they would ask him.
Or it is written, such and such.
It is written. Have you not read?
And so we should do a couple of shows on that, Gary. Some of the ways Jesus used Scripture, how he logically, and there's a book on Jesus the logician. Did you know that? It's a fairly new book on Jesus as a logician, how he used words and ideas in a logical, rational fashion that was in contrast to sometimes what the rabbis did, because they all just sat around and almost played games with the Scriptures, which is what he was trying to teach them. And
right,
that's what the Sermon on the Mount is about. When he said, you've heard it said such and such, but I say unto you, Jesus was trying to tell them that their interpretation or understanding of the old law was faulty. Not that the old law was faulty.
Well, he wasn't saying, I'm changing something.
No.
He's saying, this is what it really is.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Let's go back and say what it really, you've heard it said, but let me tell you what it really says. And so that's really kind of what we do on this show, is with religious tradition and things like that. We're trying to say, let's just go back to the Bible and figure out what it says. So that's the idea. You can agree, I hope you can agree with us about that, and that's why we invite you to call in. This is a live call-in show. Didn't even tell you that in the beginning. Got off on this sidetrack here. But you can reach us at We Are Just Christians at 772-340-1590. 772-340-1590-1590. That's the number for WPSL. That's the number for us. Mike there at the station will patch you right on through to us. We can have a conversation, and you can call him up, and we'll try to take your call as soon as we can on the air. So hang on for a moment, and then we want to have a conversation with you if you'd like. We don't want to just hit and run or cut you off. We're not trying to bait you. So stick around. We'll comment on what you ask or your comment, and then we'll always give you the last word about that. So that's the show, 340-1590. We are Just Christians. Give us a call. You can also reach us on Twitter during the show at Just Christians and the number one. At Just Christians One is our Twitter handle for the show. Reach us there. You can follow along and we'll tweet out things during the week. We also have an email address, which is justchristians@att.net.
Dot right. Net.
Yeah. JustChristians@att.net.
Well, at least you didn't give out your cell phone.
I did. Every week I have this. I start saying our numbers are 772, and then my brain has to actually engage real hard, like grinding the gears on a transmission real hard to go and not give you my cell number because I say it so often during the week to people. But 772-340-1590 is the number, and we'd be glad to take your call. Well, Gary and I usually come with independently with each other with two or three things to talk about, and then we kind of react to each other. We have a conversation on this show, and we expect you want to join in, or you can change the topic of the conversation, which our callers often do. They call in
right.
And just change the subject, and we're perfectly happy with that if you'll give us a call. All right, Gary, I'll let you go first today because I got a couple of odd things here. You mentioned to me you had something to talk about. What's on your mind?
Well, you know, a few weeks ago we did something called the Antichrist hoax.
Uh-huh.
You remember that?
Yes.
Well, today I've got something called the Tribulation hoax.
Oh, this ought to be interesting.
Well, you know, that's part of a premillennial doctrine that talks about the rapture or actually, and there's a movie called Left Behind, I think. As a matter of fact, I think there's been a couple of movies.
Books and a couple of movies, yes.
Yeah, that have talked about that, where those who are believers are virtually taken from earth almost bodily. They just disappear. And then after that, there's 7 years of real severe tribulation. And I just wanted to say, Mike, that there is not a single New Testament scripture that supports that.
As there being one period called the tribulation.
Or
there's periods of time that are called tribulation.
Or a rapture right. Followed by a 7 year tribulation.
Yes, okay. Or the idea of a rapture. Of course, rapture is used in the Bible. It means a catching away or snatching.
Yeah.
But the rapture, as it's now proposed by dispensational premillennialists, is not in the Bible as such.
Right. And as it hasn't occurred yet in the books, it's still future to us. It's some 2,000 plus years probably after Jesus was born. So I wanted to look at some basic flaws in the interpretation of the scriptures that are used to support that. The tribulation,
yeah, okay,
yes.
All right.
One of them is Matthew 24, verses 15 through 22. Mike, you're probably familiar with mm-hmm. this. And the other one is,
are too, a lot of them.
Yeah, is a parallel passage in Luke 21, 22-22 that doesn't really mention a tribulation, which is one of my points. But let's read Matthew 24:15-22 for just real quickly. And Jesus is speaking to his disciples or his apostles, and he says, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house, and let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. And pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. For then there will be a great tribulation, not a,
will be great tribulation. Right.
Such as not been seen since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved." Basically, I've omitted the last few verses of parts of that. But I want to point out that the parallel passage in Luke 21, beginning in verse 20, says, "But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies," you know, he's describing the same events, but a lot of confusion occurs over that abomination of desolation. But Luke says basically that abomination of desolation is the surrounding of Jerusalem by armies. which is one thing we don't do. But I want to mention
there's a historical context put into it.
Right.
This is something. Well, go ahead. I'll let you go into
that. I wanted to mention, he says, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, or but when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies. The article I was looking at was talking about the Greek that's used there for you. And you're a better Greek scholar than I am, Mike. I can't go into the details. But basically, the author of the article was saying the you there has a time significance involved in it. That he is speaking directly to the people that are there with him at the time when he says you.
Which verse again is that?
Verse.
I'm looking at some couple things here.
Okay, that's Matthew 24:15 and Luke 21:20.
21:20.
Okay, but he says basically the you there is in the Greek indicates that he's speaking directly to those people who are standing there listening to him at the time.
You see is the idea. We get video from that.
Okay. Basically, the point that this scholar was making about that is, if you were true to the Greek interpretation, and Jesus was looking at something that was 2,000 years in the future, he would have had to have said, when they see these things.
Or when Jerusalem is surrounded by armies. He would have left it indefinite.
Right.
But this idea puts it, and I think that's correct. He's speaking to those people, and he says, when you see this, not when it happens, you'll see this. This will be true. So yes, he's talking, he doesn't say you'll know, you'll understand, or it will be. He just says, you'll see it.
You'll see it.
Who is that? Who's the you?
And basically his point is, if he was talking about somebody 2,000 years in the future, he says, when they see these things, would have had to have been, the usage would have been a different Greek tense of the verb, or how it works. I thought that was a pretty telling description of how, if you take this tribulation to be the tribulation that they're talking about, it's already passed.
Right, just like a lot of these other things. Well, Gary relates, I don't want to get you sidetracked, but just let me just throw this out here real quickly, that these things get linked up with the coming of the Lord.
Yes.
That word coming, or presence sometimes. And once again, in the original language, the coming or the presence, it's not always, in fact, I don't think most times it is, it's not referring to the second coming.
Or it's not referring to the final coming.
The final coming
of
Christ.
We see in the final judgment.
It just means the appearing. And so it can be said that God appeared in judgment, or came in judgment upon Jerusalem, upon the nations, all throughout the Old Testament in several events. And Christ came in judgment upon the Jews and the Roman Empire at different times in the New Testament. He came in judgment upon the Jews, AD 70, which is, I think, what these events are referring to. It doesn't mean that the second coming is past, or the final coming of Christ is past, but he did come in judgment. And we see this in the book of Revelation, too. And that word just means an appearance, or appearing.
Right.
And so you got to keep that in mind when you look at the
If you go ahead and read all of Luke 21 through 22, let me finish that.
All right.
It becomes a little bit more clear of what he's talking about is this tribulation. He says, but when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, similar to the Matthew text. Let those who are in the midst of her depart, and let not those who are in the country enter her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. Basically, Jesus is saying God's going to take vengeance on the physical nation of Judah and Jerusalem over the things that they had done in the past. And in particular, I think he's talking about the rejection of the Messiah.
Right. And that's the judgment that was put upon them
because
of their crucifixion of Christ.
Right. And that judgment took place, and he used the instrument of the Roman army in August of 70 AD.
Right. That's right.
And one other passage I want to note that goes along with this, I think, that supports this interpretation of those Greek words is Matthew 24:32-35. When he says, now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So you also, when you see all these things, again, you see all these things, know that it is near at the door. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away until all these things take place.
Well, it's parallel to what he said in Mark 9:1, that there's some of you standing here today who will not taste of death until you see the kingdom of God come with power. So he's saying you are going to see it coming. Now, people can understand that, sort of, but this one they miss.
Right.
And you're probably going to come back to this, Gary. So he's given them signs that they should be able to detect this, that generation of people. But it's often read by people today on the TV and radio and the pulpits as if this is a future prophecy. And that's assuming the point to be proven. You've got to show that this is Jesus talking about something that is future to us. It was future to the people standing there. But you've got to go in the Bible and show me how it's future to us when he's saying that they're going to see it.
Yep.
Right? That's what the point you're making.
Well, verse 34, he says, "Assuredly, I say to you, this
generation."
Those two, according to the article, those two things were in agreement in terms of tense in the Greek, as those people that he was standing there talking to.
Yes.
So basically, if you look at a generation, it had to occur within the next 40 years.
Right. Sometime around that time. Jesus was speaking sometime around the year 30 A.D., plus or minus some. And this another generation is about the time that the Roman army came and destroyed, took Judea and destroyed Jerusalem.
Right.
So this generation won't pass away.
That's
until these
my point. Is this tribulation that they use as their proof text is not 2,000 years in the future. It's right then.
And I think the other thing to consider is grammatically, and you are very correct about this, the phrase "the tribulation," as you often see it written out in capital letters, "the tribulation," is not in the Bible. There is tribulation in the Bible. That word just means literally a pressing down. Thlipsis means a pressing down, anguish, affliction, trouble. And it was used of the pressing of the grapes. The grape is pressed, the skin tightens, there's pressure on it, it splits open and bursts, and then the juice comes out. So wine was made through affliction or tribulation to the grape, pressing down. And so this is the pressing down of life or events upon someone. And then, but it doesn't say the tribulation. It says there will be great tribulation, such as the world has never seen. Now, if you read the historical accounts of Josephus, a Jew, about the destruction of Jerusalem and the events that occurred to the Jews, even he says
there was nothing,
nothing like this has ever been seen before, what the Romans did to the Jews in that place and how many people died in a short time in a small place. And the other events that took place, nothing had ever been seen like that before.
Yeah, the conditions within Jerusalem by the time it was destroyed were almost unimaginable some aspects.
Well, when they laid siege to a city, they seal it all up, nothing goes in or out. Pretty soon people start eating each other, and they eat the dead bodies, and they eat whatever, the horrible things that go on, and the treachery that takes place under that pressing down. Circumstances begin to press down on people. They do unimaginable things. And then when the Romans finally did come in, when they thought that it was time to go in, oh my goodness, when they went in there,
it was bad.
They spared no man, woman, or child, or beast. And then they burned the temple to the ground, threw all the stones off. Apparently there was a watch put on the temple, Gary, from what Josephus, others say, that because it was lined, the rooms in the temple were lined with gold on the walls and everywhere else. And somehow during the night, it caught fire. There's dispute about how the fire started in the temple. Well, that gold began to melt. When the Romans realized the gold was melting, it had melted, they pulled all them rocks apart to get the gold out because it ran down in between the stones. Am I wrong about this?
Well, no, that's what he wrote. And basically, I'll just tell you, from my standpoint, that had to be a pretty hot fire, though.
I understand that, but that's why and Josephus was not a Christian; he was a Jew, and that's why that was his explanation of what Jesus had prophesied, that not one stone would be left upon another. That's why they did it, because they had intended to preserve some of this, or at least to take it apart properly.
Which is another misconception, that the Wailing Wall is part of the Temple Wall, when actually The Wailing Wall is nothing more than a retaining wall for the platform of which the temple was once built on.
Right, on the outside.
Right, so it's basically the Western Wall. The only thing I'm going to add to this, Mike, is I think a lot of this misconception about what happens comes from basically a misconception that occurred at the time about the nature of the kingdom that Jesus was going to set up. The Old Testament prophecies indicated the Messiah was going to set up a kingdom. Daniel, in particular, points basically to the nations and times, a historical roadmap to when the Messiah was coming in that fourth kingdom, which was the Roman Empire. But they expected something that he did not produce. He produced a spiritual kingdom, not a physical one. And many of the Old Testament prophecies related to that kingdom of the Messiah, I think, are misinterpreted to be a physical kingdom. So we're making, the premillennials are making...
Just like the Jews did.
Right. The premillennials today, in their interpretation of the Old Testament, are making the same mistake that the Jews did 2,000 years ago.
Right. And the primary error is to say that the Old Testament prophecies of Isaiah and Daniel have not happened yet.
Right.
When the book of Acts says that they will all be fulfilled in these days.
Well...
And so
right.
forth. And that's what Peter said in Acts chapter 3.
Well, in particular,
they
Daniel,
spoke of these days.
Yeah, in particular, Daniel was very clear that the fourth kingdom, being Babylon, the Medo-Persian Empire, the Greeks, and then the Romans, which were the fourth kingdom, he said the kingdom would be set up in those days.
And
now, if that didn't happen, then Daniel is a false prophet.
Right. But that's the fundamental belief of dispensational premillennialism. That the Old Testament, and the reason that, these can't have been fulfilled because they're only looking for a literal fulfillment, not a spiritual one. That's why they're saying that the prophecies have not been fulfilled. So you and I believe, if I understand what you're saying, Gary, that Jesus Christ came and said, I will build my church, which Peter says is the kingdom.
Right.
That
And he came in the fullness of time as God had scheduled it.
In Acts chapter 2, the scripture says that Jesus would come to sit on David's throne. And Jesus said David prophesied this as a prophet. And he, foreseeing this, Peter says, spoke of the resurrection of the Christ. Not he, foreseeing this, spoke of the coming of the millennial kingdom. That's not what Acts says. Acts says that the coming of the kingdom and Christ being seated on David's throne, which is the fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecies, happened at the resurrection. Now then, there was, I think that's a verse, I've never heard a sufficient answer from a dispensational premillennialist to Acts chapter 3 there, verse 16 through 19 or so. Never heard a good one. There's always an answer, but I never heard a satisfactory answer to Peter saying that the resurrection was the key moment when the kingdom was established. When Christ's kingdom was established, and directly in fulfillment of Samuel, of the prophecies of 1 Samuel, about David's descendants sitting on the throne. Okay, that's the throne of David. Hal Lindsey and the other millennialists, even the ones today, are still waiting for Christ to come back to Palestine and sit on David's throne. Set up a literal kingdom in Palestine or in Israel to sit on David's throne. And that is not going to happen because it's already happened that Christ came and established his spiritual kingdom at his resurrection.
And currently
sits on David's throne. In the book of 1 Corinthians 15, the very end of that chapter, well, I think it's in the 20s, I have to look up the scripture now, says that then cometh the end when he's made all enemies under his footstool, and then he says he will return the kingdom to God. He can't return something to God that he doesn't have. Okay?
Right.
Now, so in other words, and that's what Christ meant after his resurrection when he said, in Matthew 28, all authority has been given to me in heaven and earth. If that's not a kingdom, I don't know what is. You see what I'm trying to get at? So there's lots of things that people have been told about these prophecies that simply are not not the case. Now, that's not to say that we won't see tribulation in future times from the time of the first century.
Well,
the book of Revelation, however you interpret it, seems to predict that all down through time in history, cycles of persecution would come about.
Right.
And that's what the book of Revelation is teaching.
Well, there's an old saying about history repeats itself, Mike. I think Mark Twain had a little bit better take on it when he says, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme.
That's probably correct, more correct, isn't it? Yes.
Right.
It does rhyme. Well, you can see that the same forces that brought about the persecution and the tribulation in the first century or before the first century are still at work in human societies because humans are the same.
Right.
And worldly kingdoms do not like anything above their head. They just do not like God in heaven being above their head. And they will always persecute those who have an allegiance to something besides them. That's what's going on in Europe today. That's what's going on in the United States today. The secular governments are going to begin to persecute Christians because we do not recognize that the federal government is the ultimate authority of right and wrong.
Right.
See, Gary, when they have a Supreme Court decision, even a divided one that says that such and such is true, the way secular people think is that all citizens of the United States must bow down now and kiss the earth and say, well, that must be right. That must be true. That must be good. But you and I can't do that. Not when they rule the kind of things that they do
right
about abortion and gay marriage and things like that. You and I can't bow that down and kiss the earth before the great throne, the great image of Nebuchadnezzar. Can we?
Right.
We're not
because
going to. And so
all authority has been given to Jesus.
Nebuchadnezzar
and
doesn't
he
like
wrote
it.
What those
when we don't bow down, Nebuchadnezzar doesn't like it. And so persecution is going to happen.
Right.
All right, we have a caller, Gary. You ready to
imagine that?
Okay, Ken, are you there?
Are you here?
Are you there, Ken? Go right ahead. What's on your mind today? Oh boy. Thank you.
Yeah. Verse 21.
Matthew 24:21. Okay.
Let me look that up real quick.
It says, then there will be great tribulation such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor shall ever be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. Okay? Yes, I believe, and I believe the verses before that about not going back in the field when you see these armies surrounding Jerusalem, hoping you're not pregnant hope it's not the winter of the Sabbath day when everything will be closed down. I believe those are referring to the time of Jerusalem. They only make sense in the context to me of the Roman armies surrounding Jerusalem in AD 70 when they made their appearance. Jesus warned them, people who see this better pay attention. Because it's going to be too late very soon to escape. Now, what do you think about that, Ken? Verse 29. Okay.
It says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the heavens and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. My take on that is that this is apocalyptic language. It is apocalyptic language that signifies the changes in powers and authorities and governing entities. And that governing entities shifted once the Romans destroyed the temple. Basically, the Jewish law and everything was completely wiped away because they
destroyed the rabbinical system, the system of sacrifices.
And when he says he will send his angels with a great sound and trumpet, again, apocalyptic language, the gospel spread throughout the earth. And basically, the gospel is collecting from the four winds all of the people that answer the gospel into his kingdom.
Well, this scattered Christians who were in Jerusalem, scattered them greatly. Even more so than the events of Saul's persecution, where in Acts 9 it says that they went about teaching the word when they had to leave Jerusalem, that area. and they began to spread the gospel. But these events just scattered them everywhere. Now, apocalyptic language is, which I'm sure, Ken, you're probably familiar with, is a type of literature in which there's Book of Zechariah is apocalyptic, some of Daniel, Ezekiel is apocalyptic.
Part of
using,
Acts 2.
And then there's a few places Joel. In the New Testament. Acts 2, Joel 2, quoted in Acts 2. The book of Revelation is apocalyptic, where signs and symbols are used. And they may seem like us to be exaggerations, like some of the Old Testament prophecies, you know, talk about the whole earth. Well, it's talking about pretty much everybody that you know, that kind of thing. And the even Joseph in his dreams, dreaming that the sun, the moon bowed down to him, is often believed to be kind of a symbol, because later in life that came true, that his mother and father and brothers all bowed down to him, which was a shift in power. Him being one of the younger brothers, now even his father bows down to him. And so forth. So that's why it came to mean a change of authority. Now then, I think these events, what he's saying, what Gary's saying partly, Ken, is that these events definitely fit the destruction of Jerusalem, and even as apocalyptic language. Okay, go ahead. No. I don't think it is, but no. What do you think, Gary?
No, it's not. I differ a little bit from Mike. I don't think there's anything in Matthew 24 that refers to the final coming or what people often call the second coming.
Now, it could, verse 30 could be. I don't say that it can't be. I try to keep it in its context because I take another view of...
Those that understood the scriptures would see the things that happen as a coming in judgment of the Messiah. Particularly if you want to go back to even Daniel chapter 9, where he says at that point in the passage, the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city, Jerusalem. Right. That I think that this is a fulfillment of that Daniel prophecy. And I'll go even a little bit further and tell you that I think this is a fulfillment of Isaiah 11, 10 through 12.
Which say what? For our listeners.
Isaiah 10 through 12. And in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, who shall stand as a banner to the people. For the Gentiles shall seek him, and his resting place shall be glorious. It shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again this second time to recover the remnant of his people who are left. And he lists several countries. He will set up a banner for the nations in verse 12 and will assemble the outcast of Israel and gather together dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. That's the gospel.
Right. I have two things about this, Ken. Number one, if I can remember them both, here's where Gary and I differ on this chapter, if I can express this clearly, Gary, you can tell me. I think the second coming may be in this chapter, but it's after verse, he says in verse 34, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. That's all the things he's talked about before that, including verse 30 and 31, okay? Now then he says, in verse 36, but of that day and hour, now because the disciples, beginning of the chapter, ask him two or three questions at the beginning of the chapter. When will this temple be destroyed, and when will be the end of the world, more or less, or the end of these things? But he says, but of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noah, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as the days before the flood, speaking, I think of a different coming. And he goes on to say that there'll be two men in the field and so forth, and one is taken, one is left. And he says, you watch because you don't know what time that's going to happen. Now, I think that may be a reference to the second coming, that Christ doesn't even know the day of the second coming. It's obvious Christ knew when these events would happen, the destruction of Jerusalem, because he's told them when they would happen. He said even they can know. Take a look. You see the fig tree, you'll know. You'll see the armies surrounding Jerusalem. You can know that. But of that day and hour, then no one knows. So, now Gary doesn't agree with that, and I know lots of people that don't, and I've almost been persuaded to change my mind on that. I'm still thinking about it. So,
well, of the exact day and hour when that was going to happen, when you saw Jerusalem surrounded by armies, they knew to get out and leave. But of the exact time or day and hour, which, if that's literal,
I just don't think that's
literal.
I don't think that's what he's saying at all. I think that's what
he's saying. I take that mainly from the beginning of chapter 25 because he mentions two judgments here. And he keeps saying two men will be in the field, one will be taken and the other and left. Two women will be grinding, one will be taken the other and left. The final judgment.
I don't think that's literal either. I think that's an expression of something happening suddenly and unexpectedly and strangely.
Right, but that doesn't fit basically the fact that the final judgment is going to include everyone. Nobody's going to escape the final judgment.
Well, I don't think he's saying, well, anyway, we can get too deep. Ken has something to say. Hang on.
Okay, now, when you come down to 25 verse 1, after these events, he says, then the kingdom of heaven will be likened to 10 virgins, and he changes the description of the judgments to be all-encompassing. He says, after the events of these days, and I believe this is true, after the events of basically those days, he says, then the kingdom of heaven will be like, and he changes the description. And so that's one of the reasons why
we have to discuss what the kingdom of heaven is.
Yeah, basically what we're going back to is, I think this can very well fit Verse 36 on can very well fit the destruction of Jerusalem.
I see that. All right, Ken, we didn't let you finish what you were saying. Go ahead.
Go right ahead.
If you can remember. Is apocalyptic? Well, because that's the kind of language it is. I think most Bible commentators will tell you that it's apocalyptic because it's using the signs of the tribes mourning, the coming on the clouds with power and glory, the great trumpets, the sun being darkened, the moon, stars falling from heaven, you know.
Take a look at the same.
How can a star fall from heaven to the earth, literally? If premillennial dispensationalists are looking for a time when the stars fall from the heavens, where are they falling to? I mean, it doesn't make any sense in a literal way. Stars are much bigger than the earth. How are they going to fall to the earth? And if not, where are they going to fall to? How do stars even fall anywhere in space? That implies gravity and going. You see, so it's obviously a symbolic apocalyptic language.
It's very similar to the language I think that's used in Zechariah 12 and 13. When he talks about these things, some of these things happening, there will be mourning, particularly the mourning that's mentioned, is mentioned in Zechariah 12, 10 and following. He talks about the mourning in the plain of Megiddo, and then he turns right around and says, in that day a fountain shall be opened for the house of David, for the inhabitants of Jerusalem, for sin and uncleanness. He's talking about the gospel here. He's predicting what kind of kingdom.
Not what says, which verse?
That in that day a fountain shall be opened for the house of David, for the inhabitants of Jerusalem, for sin and uncleanness.
What?
The house of David is the spiritual kingdom. He's a Jew.
Christ is sitting on David's throne, I believe now, according to Acts chapter 2.
Right.
And so the house of David are God's people. I think that's the prophecy that Gary's talking about.
Yeah. You know, Paul says the Jew is not the physical Jew. The Jew is the spiritual Jew who makes up that kingdom.
Go ahead, Ken. Tell us why you think that. Okay. What possibility are we eliminating? Just so everybody's clear. What's that? That Matthew 24 could be referring both to the destruction of Jerusalem and the second coming? Oh, the house of David. Could be that he's going to save the Jewish nation as a nation? Okay. Well, the house of David, was that the Jewish nation? Is that what he's referring to? Okay, go ahead. I thought I'd lost you there for a minute.
I'm missing him, Mike.
I think
we're losing him.
Yeah, I think we lost. Oh, boy. Maybe there's issues with Ken. If you can still hear me, call back because I think I just heard it click and we lost you. Now there is a position, Gary, that is taken, and while Ken is calling back, if you can hear us, Ken, call back. We certainly didn't cut you off. I think the position that Ken is expressing, I don't want to put words in his mouth, is taken by many people that says that God still intends to save the Jewish people as a nation, not as individuals. The New Testament seems to teach primarily that if any Jew will be saved, it'll be saved, as Peter says, the same way as the Gentiles, or the Gentiles be saved the same way as the Jews. Not all the Gentiles were saved as a nation, but as individuals. That Peter says that anyone in any nation who comes and works righteousness, God will accept. That's what he said at the house of Cornelius in Acts 10, correct?
Right.
Whoever of any nation who comes. So you have this belief, though, that Israel is going to be saved more in a generic way or as a group, that Christ will come and save them in a miraculous way. Ken, are you back?
We're still getting
Not yet. Okay. Call back again, Ken, if you didn't hear me before. We haven't got you back yet. But that's and sometimes they go to Romans chapter 9 to say that so shall all Israel be saved, which would predicate a miraculous conversion of the Jews since they rejected him. And one of the bases of the whole premillennial doctrine, Gary, is the paragraph or the postponement theory that Christ couldn't save the Jews when he came the first time because they rejected him. So he kind of made this parenthesis. I said paragraph. He made a parenthesis in history called the church and postponed his kingdom until his second coming so that he can save the Jews miraculously then. That's the basis of Hal Lindsey's, which has become the fundamental
right.
premillennial dispensationalist doctrine since the 70s, early 70s. Ken, are you back again? Go right ahead. Now, finish what you were saying. Why can't it be both? That's what you were, I think that's where I lost you. You're saying we've eliminated the possibility it can be both. So explain that, what that means to you. I don't believe that. I believe the context determines what Israel is talking about.
The context does.
Go ahead. You don't believe that all references refer to the church of Israel? Well, I'll give you a case in point, a point to prove your a point, Ken. Romans 10:1. Brethren, Paul speaking, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they may be saved. For I bear them witness they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge, and so forth. So, that obviously is, I think...
You lost it.
I think we've lost our entire connection, so hang on a minute here. Those of you who are waiting, maybe we have lost our entire connection to Skype this morning. Yeah.
Okay.
We back now? Wow, what's going on this morning? We got a lot of crazy things. Is Ken still there? I'm sorry, bud. I don't know what's going on today. We've been doing so good with our Skype connection, but today it's not so well. What I was reading, and I don't know if you heard this, and you probably agree with me about this, that Romans 10:1, where Paul prays that Israel might be saved, I don't think he's referring to the church there. He's referring to physical Israel, Jews, as we would call them, or as a nation. And he says that they have this desire for zeal for God, but they don't have it according to knowledge. And he's appealing to them to come and accept the righteousness of Christ, right? And so forth. And to confess, then he goes on to talk about believing and confessing and all these things in Romans 10. So there are several cases in the New Testament where Israel does not refer to the church. I think there are many that do refer to Israel as the church, or the church as God's Israel today. But I can't. I don't think it's right to say that all references are that way. Well, go ahead now. Finish what you're saying. So we agree that not all references to Israel are about the church. The question is any particular reference mentioning of it the church? That's the question. Okay. I'm
yeah,
here.
We're,
go ahead.
We're here.
I'm a judge, yes. It always comes back to chickens, doesn't it? Go ahead. Okay. All right. Okay. Well, I got you. Got once again, for you to know which chicken I'm talking about, you have to look at the context of what I'm saying, and he's talking to this generation. He's talking to real people in front of him. And he says, this generation will not pass away. How do you think they understood that? My question, first of all, how do you think they understood it?
That was part of the point that I had earlier, Ken, about what the Greek implies. There were different tenses of the Greek verb, and I'm not a Greek scholar, but the argument was very good that the you in those passages and the this of that generation were directed exactly to the people who were talking, he was talking to at the time, that if it was in the Greek in a different way, to mean something 2,000 years in the future or more, he would have had to have say, when they see this. That's the Greek use.
The word this generation, there's nothing that I can see that is particularly special about that word. It's the ordinary word for this particular thing that we would say, and I think what Gary is trying to say is that when it's used in a context with real people standing right there, and he's been talking about a particular generation of events, particular things about Jerusalem and those stones being overturned and armies coming, and then he says this generation, well, he's talking about the generation that's standing there. It seems that's the most, let's put it this way, if that's not what it means, then the most obvious first meaning of the word, and I think all sound Bible interpretation starts there. You start with what is the most obvious interpretation of words, and then you move away from that if you have to. I don't know what it is about this passage that forces me to move away. For example, Ken, this morning I'm going to be reading Jesus' words in Matthew 7, do not cast your pearls before swine, or give that which is holy unto the dogs. Now, is he really referring to pigs and dogs there? Now, that's my first thought. And that has to be my first thought. Well, it's pretty clear from the context that it's nonsense for him to really be talking about. The main point he's saying is, oh, by the way, all these great things I'm saying is from that. I want you to know that if you have any valuable pearls laying around, don't throw them in the pig pen. Is he really saying that? I think that most people say no. He's obviously there using those words metaphorically. Now, I've just went from the most obvious literal interpretation, and because that is nonsense or doesn't seem to fit the context, I move to a metaphorical or secondary interpretation. Now, what my question is to those who take the position about this generation and lots of other language like this, what is it in the passage that forces me to move away from the fact that Jesus is talking about this generation that was standing right there hearing his words? Huh? What's that? What was it? Go ahead. Well, 29 and 30 is apocalyptic language anyway, most
Either
likely.
Way.
Even if it's referring to the second coming. What are those days? What's that? I don't believe what's happened. Oh, no, I don't believe it's happened yet. Because the resurrection hasn't happened. But see, Christ has come many times, and I believe God came in His judgment of Israel many times before a final judgment. I think that point is pretty much agreed by a lot of scholars that the coming, that's what I was making about the appearing. The word coming does not always refer to the second coming. It refers to an appearing of Christ. And I believe Christ did appear in judgment upon the Jews in AD 70. And He could be seen by them, as it were, if they were looking, in judgment upon them. He predicted He was going to do it. He came and destroyed them, just like He said He would, with the overturning of the temple and the stones and everything. And that's what the apostles were asking about. They thought, I have to tell you, Ken, I think the apostles thought that the temple would stand until the end of time. And I imagine they believed that temple would still be there when Christ came back a second time, if they even believed that. But obviously that didn't happen that way. So that already all of us living in the 21st century are having to reevaluate the time sequence of Jesus' words in Matthew 24 and in Luke 21. Because
Luke 21,
the temple did not mean the end. It meant, let's put it this way, the temple was the end of the world to the Jewish nation. It was the end of the world. That's how they viewed it then, the end of the world. Because their world, their civilization as such, was destroyed. And has never recovered completely from that altogether. And I don't think it ever will. But that's another issue. Their world was destroyed.
Looking back to Luke 21, it becomes a little bit... I'm trying to harmonize Matthew 24 and Luke 21 in a lot of ways.
I think they do harmonize.
But when he says, but when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. And he talks about those fleeing to the mountains. What good does it do to flee to the mountains if this is a final judgment?
Exactly.
But verse 22...
Well, that's what he says early in Matthew 24. This can't be the second coming.
Yeah, verse 22 is really telling about what this is all about. He says, for these are the days of vengeance that all things which are written may be fulfilled. Zechariah predicted the destruction of Jerusalem. Daniel predicted the destruction of Jerusalem, all after the Babylonian destruction.
If this is the second coming, why do you flee to the mountains and hope it's not time when you're pregnant? Now, here's the answer to that, Gary. It's because these events are before the second. See, Ken, I think you've backed yourself in a corner here, and I don't mean that in a bad way. You're trying to convince me from verses 29 and 30 that this generation refers to some generation at the end of time. But the only way you can do that and harmonize it with fleeing to the mountains and all that is if you say, well, there's this period of time before the second coming, which is called a great tribulation. It may be 1,000 years before the second coming. See, and that's what some dispensationalists do, Gary. They put the tribulation
before the millennium.
Before the millennium.
Yeah, there's premillennial and post-millennial.
But see, there's no millennium in Matthew 24 or Luke 21. That's the problem that millennials have with this. There's no millennium. There's no kingdom. There's no paradise here. These are simply events that all come one upon another. There's no pause here. Well, what good at the end of the world would do you to flee Jerusalem or to hope the mountains fall on you or to not hope you're not pregnant at the second coming? See, that's why they can't. True millennials, Ken, and I don't know what your position is, do not make those signs about the second coming. They make them about this. That's why they have to make up this period of time called the Great Tribulation, where we started this morning, to separate that from the second coming. And I believe it is separate because it's not even talking about the same time. Now, let me ask you something, though, Ken. If the words, and these things, this generation will not pass away, if that doesn't mean the generation who Jesus was talking about, what generation is that? All right, well, what What possible value is that? That's a nonsensical statement on Jesus' part. Of course these things will happen to the generation that's alive then. That has no meaning whatsoever to say, here's what's going to happen at the end of time. And oh, by the way, the generation that's alive then, these things are going to happen to them. Well, of course it's going to happen to them if they're alive then at the second coming. Of course they won't pass away. If it's the end of time, of course that last generation won't pass away till all these things are accomplished. The statement becomes nonsense if it's interpreted as being the second coming.
I don't know that it becomes nonsense, but it doesn't tell them anything about what he's apparently trying to tell them. He's trying to tell them about the time this is going to occur.
Let me make a prediction for you. How do you like this prophecy? All the events surrounding the second coming will happen to the people that are alive then. What a great prophet I am. Of course they're going to happen to the people that are alive then. That's what I mean by the statement. I don't mean Christ is speaking nonsense. I mean, that interpretation doesn't make sense in the day in which Christ spoke it or at the second coming.
All right, if all this is going to happen to the people that see it,
of course it's going to happen to them that see it.
Of course it's going to happen to the people. It doesn't tell you anything about the time.
It makes sense for him to tell them, now, you people standing here, this is going to happen in your lifetime. You need to pay attention to me. Now, that makes tremendous sense in the context. But to take it and move it to some future generation and say that's the end of time, it makes no sense in the context.
Doesn't tell you which generation at all.
I can predict that people that get into car accidents today are going to have an accident, a wreck. I mean, that's not a I'm sorry, I'm getting kind of overstating things here, but it doesn't. I don't see how that helps you in the proper interpretation of this passage. It doesn't help you to go away from the apocalyptic language, because these events can't literally happen, as far as I can see, even if it's the end of time. How do all of the tribes of the earth mourn at the second coming of Christ? According to his own statement, we don't even know when it's going to happen, and it's going to happen in the twinkling of an eye, he says in other places. And that's why they have to separate the actual second coming from the events of the great tribulation. And yet in this verse, if you interpret this generation differently, the second coming and the great tribulation are all pressed in against each other with no separation by 1,000 years or 7 years or anything. They're all pressed into the same event. All right, Ken, I've been talking for a while. We got a minute and a half left. We'll let you have the last word. I know, and I'm not putting that on you. Don't get me wrong. I apologize for that. I'm not putting that on you. I'm speaking to our audience in a general term. All right. All right. I'll accept that. I understand what you're saying. I don't agree that that is a necessary conclusion from that. But I do understand what you're saying, and I think it's a good point that should be mentioned. Yes. And there are lots of people that agree that that's a problem, what you just said.
One of the reasons why I don't think that's part of the second coming. I think that this entire chapter goes to chapter 25 when he says, but then the kingdom, after all the events of these days that he's described, then we're going to be in a position where the next thing that's going to happen is the final coming.
All right, guys, we got less than a minute. Ken, one sentence, and then we're going to have to go. Okay, I really appreciate your calling. You've raised a lot of good issues. I thank you so much for calling in today, especially calling back more than once. I appreciate it. All right, we're going to have to go today. Thanks for your tenacity, and we thank you for listening. Please take a look at our website, wearejustchristians.com. Wearejustchristians.com. And tune in again next week to our show at 9 o'clock on Sunday morning. Until then, may God bless you in your search to find him. Thank you very much.
Fulfill my cup, they overflow. Fulfill my cup.